Okay, so we've seen then the structure so far is what in the shorthand of the book is referred to as experience, understanding, and judgment. And next, related to all of that, in this book he makes an insight, he makes an initial move toward clarifying what he would later acknowledge as a distinct and fourth level of consciousness, the level of decision. It is not acknowledged as distinct in insight, but it is brought in as an extension of knowing in insight. He later changes that perspective, or gives us a different perspective. The language that insight will use, so let's skip that up here. It's a further set of questions, questions for deliberation. What am I to do about it? That leads to this. There's four levels. And in his work, I mean, it's really just very almost immediately after the publication of the book that he realized that decision is distinct. Distinct enough to be called another level of consciousness that really can't be collapsed into understanding and judgment. So the language that insight will use for the clearing of the common ground is the self-appropriation of one's rational self-consciousness. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But before he turns to decision and ethics, he also draws out the implications of the self-affirmation of experience, understanding, judgment, the empirically, intelligently, and rationally conscious knowing subject, by outlining an integral heuristic structure of the known, that is to say, a metaphysics, which I think is a brilliant beginning on the overcoming of the fragmentation of knowledge itself, chapters 14 to 17. With the eventual recognition that decision names a fourth level of activity beyond those constituting us as knowers, Lonergan gradually shifted the language for the space of the common ground from rational self-consciousness to intentionality. And that's under the influence of his reading of Edmund Husserl. The normative source of meaning consists of more than the acts of meaning that in insight are called formal acts of meaning and full acts of meaning, that is to say, conceptualization and judgment. Meaning is effective and constitutive. It's constitutive of the human world. It's constitutive of community. It's constitutive of ourselves as persons. And grounding its constitutive function is the world constitution and the self-constitution, the making of being, that occurs in the existential moments when we realize that it is up to ourselves to decide individually and commonly what we are going to make of ourselves. The whole decision level. Lonergan's later reflections on these moments, for example in Method and Theology, go far beyond the limited and somewhat limiting analysis of decision in insight. And my guess is that you will experience the limiting context when we read chapter 18. It's not broad enough to cover what goes on and when we have to make decisions. So it goes far beyond that, even as they preserve insight's essential grasp of the utter contingency of decision and action in relation to the knowledge that precedes it. In other words, decision is free. It's not determined by the knowledge that precedes it. It's contingent with respect to the knowledge. One month? Yes.
I'm sorry. Does decision then correlate with the making of being?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Fourth level correlates with the making of being. On my own interpretation, in insight, Lonergan is offering an account of the operations entailed in decision that would correspond to what St. Ignatius Loyola calls the third time of election. That is the time in which the subject deciding is in a state of equilibrium, and so is free to use his or her powers of intelligence and rationality to arrive at a good decision. Whereas in Method and Theology, the account shifts, and here, the operations that are described and related to one another match more closely Ignatius' second time of election. In which one must weigh the poles and counterpoles of affectivity and go with what leads to equilibrium, peace, and self-transcendence. Ignatius, St. Ignatius in the Spiritual Exercises specifies that there are three times for making a decision, or three moments of decision. I can get rid of some of this. And he gives us an example of the first time St. Paul on the road to Damascus. And, you know, there's just no further questions about what he's supposed to do. That's it, it's clear. Or Matthew, when Jesus says, come follow me. The first time is when God so enters into one's life that one knows, without any further reflection, what is to be done. And there are no further questions about it. The second time, the three times are exhaustive of all possibilities, because either there are no further questions, as in the first time, the first moment, or there are, as in the second and third. And if there are further questions, either one is in a state of equanimity, not being moved by the pulls and counterpulls of desire and affect in different directions. If one is in a state of equanimity, one uses a particular method that is more a use of one's reason and intelligence. Or one is not in a state of equanimity, but is being pulled in different directions. And then what one has to do is to read what's going on in the different directions, and where they are leading, and what kind of state they're leading to, and what kind of person I would become if I went this way and that way, and so on and so forth. Okay, so what I'm saying is that, and Lonergan is profoundly Ignatian in his background, and I think in Insight, he's really giving us a philosophical presentation, a decision that matches what Ignatius was talking about in the third topic, where you use rational modes of, you know, lining up the cons and pros of different alternatives. So, in method and theology, the feeling is much more prominent in this thinking. His discussion of decision is in terms that correspond to St. Ignatius' second time in the lecture. The question remains, of course, as to what, in Lonergan's terms, matches what St. Ignatius calls equilibrium. And I would suggest that this, the structure of self-transcendence in knowledge, decision, and religion, as that structure is permeated by feeling. It's, again, you could say self-transcendent affectivity, in Lonergan's terms, is what Ignatius means by equilibrium. That, again, is an attempt to relate a contemporary, more or less contemporary Jesuit to the first Jesuit, and to say how I think Lonergan appropriated Ignatius's heritage. At any rate, one of the new emphases in the unfolding of the common ground or the normative source of meaning is the role that he would later accord to feeling, which is far stronger in his later work than it will be in Insight. Potential values are apprehended in intentional feelings. That is to say, in those feelings that respond to an apprehended object or course of action. If I suggest something to you that I think would be good for you, your response is likely to be affected, either positively or negative. Potential value is apprehended in an intentional feeling. The process of deliberation that follows is one in which a person ascertains whether the possible value thus apprehended is truly or only apparently good. Truly good, while it may also be immediately satisfying, isn't discerned on that basis of satisfaction, because what is satisfying may also not be a genuine good. Rather, the truly good is what carries us to transcendence. And on that basis, Lonergan, in his later work, suggests a normative scale of values that I believe is of utmost importance for historical understanding and action. Values are vital, social, cultural, personal, and religious, in an ascending order of self-transcendence. So vital, social, cultural, personal, religious, and those really correspond to experience, social, to understanding of cultural, to reflection and judgment, personal, to decision, and religious, to a possible fifth level of consciousness. Whether he held a fifth level or not is subject to debate. I think he did. That scale of values, the levels of value, are then related in a complex fashion that I tried to fill out in Theology and the Dialectics of History. For example, and this is what we're concerned about here in this course, the collaborative and communicative process of open and honest conversation about what is most important for human living would be what Lonergan would call a cultural value. Is that possible in a given society? Does the society allow that kind of open and honest conversation? But it arises upon, and it is conditioned by, the infrastructural foundation of the social institutions that either encourage its occurrence, or in Habermas's terms, more or less systematically distort communication. It depends on the authenticity of the person's personal value to engage in it, and so on the extent and solidity of the processes of conversion, religious value, that they have undergone. So these are all related to each other up and down. And to the extent that it is effective, it changes both these persons in their capacity as originating personal value, that is conversion, and it changes the social institutions that constitute part of the infrastructural mix. Okay, so with the acknowledgement of decision as a distinct level, an acknowledgement that was firmly in place by 1957, after the publication of the book, but right after, he began to move to the articulation of a far richer notion of the human good than the purely cognitional foundations of insight permitted. And we'll discuss this when we get to chapter 18. The grounds for its unfolding lie at least in part in the integration, the deliberation effects, an integration of the knowing that insight differentiated and of the feeling that is acknowledged in the later works as a distinct element in the normative source of meaning, the common ground of communication and collaboration. So to this point, then, the common ground, when it is appropriated, is a distinct plateau consisting of four levels of intentional consciousness. In Lonergan's shorthand, experience, understanding, judgment, and decision, and of the feelings that are the mass and momentum of intentional consciousness and that must be submitted to a self-appropriation analogous to that which Lonergan's analysis of intentionality enables with respect to operations. We'll see in chapters 6 and 7 a discussion of four types of bias, and one of the biases is a psychic bias. It's called dramatic bias. And the others affect more or less consciousness in its intentional capacities, the consciousness of the knower. But there is a psychic one, or a dramatic bias, that was first discovered by Freud, even though his understanding of it might not be entirely satisfactory, and is not. And he certainly discovered that there are psychic roots. There's a psychogenetic origin to certain human waywardness. It is not a matter of, approximately at least, of knowledge, problem of knowledge. It's a problem that originates at the psychic or affective level. Right. The next step, and we're getting close to the end of this, in clearing the common ground in his own developments, I'm taking you through as a sort of sweep overview of the whole thing, or in the ascent to a new plateau of meaning, or the articulation of a normative source of meaning, is the revelation and appropriation of love as the supreme instance of personal value and the highest confluence of intentional operation with feeling. This theme emerges with particular poignancy in the late essays published in the third collection, which was published after Lonergan's death in 1985. Love is total commitment. whether in intimacy or in the family or in interpersonal relations or in the civic community or in relationship with transcendent wisdom. It can be so powerful as to dismantle previous horizons, reveal new values that one could not previously have apprehended, and start one on a whole new course of living, transform one into a new creation. Its working, then, is often strangely independent of the upwardly moving creative dynamism that proceeds through knowledge to decision. It would seem, sometimes at least, that if it proceeds from any knowledge and decision, the knowledge and decision that it proceeds from are not ours but God's. In other words, love is a gift, and it comes from elsewhere. The kind of love that Lonergan is speaking about is really a creative participation in the passive spiration within the triune God that is the Holy Spirit. Proceeding as love from the Father as agape and the Father's word as wisdom and judgment of God. So he's writing to the theological there at that point, going to the Trinitarian dimensions of theology. Love has a movement through the common ground that is inverse to the upward movement that has preoccupied us to this point. And we can use a spatial metaphor, experience, understanding, judgment, decision moving from below upwards. Love goes the other way. It first reveals values, which is at the decision level. It reveals values in their splendor and efficacy, and transvalues our values as it shapes a new horizon. It then discloses among values the value of truth, and so it strengthens us in the pursuit of intelligibility and truth through our cognitive operations. And usually ever so slowly, it can transform our very sensitive, dramatic, and intersubjective spontaneity. So that the body joins the psyche and the spirit in one total loving commitment. One complete yes to existence in the cosmos and to our negotiated and discerned place within it. And that's what is meant by a saint, I think, is someone where that has happened. And it is my view that the most important moment or step in Lonergan's clearing of a common ground on which all men and women could, if they so wish, meet, was formulated only after all of these elements had been worked out in his major writing. Because in some of the essays that he wrote in the last 10 years of his life, he portrays this four-tiered structure of intentional consciousness and concomitant feeling, experience, understanding, judgment, decision, as open on both ends. Open to what he variously calls a tidal movement that precedes waking experience on one end and that goes beyond responsible decision on the other end. Or, in another essay, he calls it the passionateness of being, that is the very upwardly and indeterminately directed universal dynamism that, as we will see in insight, he calls finality. Most significant of all is the assertion in the third collection in the paper, A Natural Right and Historical Mindedness, that the normative sense source of meaning consists of more than these operations that we've been talking about. It lies in an entire ongoing process of self-transcendence that embraces the levels of intentional operations in a more inclusive whole, underpinning the subject as experientially, intelligently, rationally, morally conscious. There is a symbolic operator that through image and affect coordinates neural processes with the goals of intentionality. It's revealed in a lot of dreams, in the dreams of the morning, for instance, what Binswanger would call the dreams of the morning, where the dreaming can be very, very powerful impetus to assuming our place in the world. Symbolic operator. And that's one instance of it. Accompanying the same subject is the mass and momentum of feeling, and going beyond the intentional operations of the subject is the operator of interpersonal relations, total commitment, and religious love. And those elements are now located not on the fourth level of intentional consciousness, but in his later work, and I think you can find evidence for this, on a level or even levels beyond what intentionality analysis alone from this purpose. So what began in insight ends up with this kind of open-ended structure. And the former ingredients introduce a most elemental level of consciousness, the symbolic operator ingredient that can be called primordial psychic process. So, just to conclude here, a couple more paragraphs. My own way of articulating this development is as follows. If intentional consciousness, at least in its dramatic pattern of operations, which is the pattern of operations in which we live our lives, the drama of our lives, intentional consciousness can be called the search for direction and the movement of life, then this tidal wave, this passionateness of being that underpins, accompanies, and overarches intentional operations is the very movement of life itself. And it too calls for negotiation, as did the intentional operations whose working and interrelations Lonergan discloses. So there's negotiating the operations, and that's what he starts us off on in himself. Negotiating them, coming to own ourselves as subjects who perform these operations. And then there's negotiating the movement itself. And each one of those negotiations has to be attentive, intelligent, reasonable, responsible. And he says in Natural Right and Historical Mindedness, the normative source of meaning is more than intelligence. It's more than insight. It's more than intentional operations. It's the dialectical interplay of these operations with an autonomous but related movement of life that begins before intentional operations in neural processes and psychic imagery and affect, and that reaches beyond intentional operations in the total being in love type of order, in families, in communities, and with God. The entire ongoing process of self-transcendence that is the normative source of meaning is more than intentional operations, and this more is what Lonergan pointed to and began to articulate towards the end of his life. And that's what I attempted to articulate in the notion of psychic, the notion that adds to what he did. And that very notion of psychic conversion, I think, brings us to, at least in my awareness, the latest step in this articulation of the common ground. And it's a step, or at least it's one that I tried to take this summer in Boston College at the lecture that I gave there. Namely, the first level of consciousness, the level called experience, where the precept, the attentive hold, is more than Lonergan was able to articulate it to be. It's a level of reception. And among the data that are received are meanings and values themselves at that level. So not just sense, impressions, and so on, which is what he emphasizes. But the sort of thing that Heidegger, if you have read Heidegger, is talking about when he speaks of Verstehen, which is the universal existential condition of Dasein, and Wittgenstein in his talk of the public meaningfulness of language. And that's the latest step, and I think it's the way to make peace, if you want, between Lonergan on the one hand Heidegger and Wittgenstein on the other, is to acknowledge that what Heidegger and Wittgenstein recognized has a very definite place in this whole structure, and very important. But anyway, our focus in this course will not be on that latest step, but on the first one, the insight into insight on which the rest of the material is built. So that's an overview of his whole development, but locating insight within Wittgenstein. The rest of our time is just open for discussion, questions, clarification, arguments. John.
Just getting back to this Ignatian distinction here, that's provocative, basically. I'm just thinking with the second one, where one is pulled in the different directions. Is there any of Lonergan's writings that would correlate more with that kind of future decision?
The second mode of election in Augustine?
Is that Ignatius.
I mean, first of all, is that Aquinas, then Augustine? But, Ignatius, the second mode of election in Ignatius.
Yeah.
I think the method in theology, the criterion for authentic decision, is self-transcendent affectivity. That is the criterion in method in theology. And I think that's Ignatius's criterion in the second mode of election. Ignatius doesn't have that language, but I think that's his criterion. So I think what Lonergan's giving us in method is a contemporary philosophical formulation, or using contemporary philosophical terms, notion of value and so on and so forth, feelings apprehending values, of what Ignatius was after in the second mode of life. And I think what he's offering in chapter 18 of Insight is philosophical, or using philosophical terms, to talk about decision making in the time or the mode that Ignatius meant when he spoke of the third. And you're in one or the other. You can't, I mean, if you're in a state of equilibrium, or if you're not in a state of equilibrium, then you can't weigh the pros and cons, because you're not in a state where you can do that. You've got to follow some other method. And it's basically staying with the affect and seeing where it's leading.
Where in the exercises would I find the modes of election?
It's in, I could actually give you the exact number, except I don't have the book. It's in the second week. And it's, is it before or after the two standards?
It's after.
It's after the two standards. But before the modes of humility, I think, the 3 degrees of humility. Or is it even after that? I'm not sure. But anyway, it's in the subtitle.
Okay, thank you.
So what I'm going to ask you to do is to read each week what is on the syllabus. So next week will be the preface and introduction. And I will have a set of notes. It won't be a lecture like this. It will be point notes that we will use as a basis. But I don't want that to become a controlling factor. It's just it helps us get going, and it keeps us rooted. And I want back and forth. I want you to be free to raise questions at any point. Questions for clarification, challenging questions, whatever. That's the method that I've used in teaching this in the past, and it's the method that I use in whenever I teach a text. Yes?
Can I just ask you to speculate? The third stage of meaning is a movement to philosophical differentiation. Have you speculated as to what a fourth stage of meaning might be?
No. I haven't, and I don't even know that we're ready to. Do you think we're ready to think about that? I mean,
I'm still trying.
Because I think we're still really struggling with the third. I don't suppose anybody has method mentality. Where he sets it up like at the end of the discussion of meaning there, and how meaning is moving into a new monitoring. There's a new area of the monitoring, and it's in all of the contemporary philosophical developments that he was aware of, were pointing in that direction. Now, obviously, he wasn't aware of postmodernism, post-structuralism, and so on. That goes thereafter. But Wittgenstein on one hand, Heidegger on the other, they're all pointing in this direction too. My estimation is the three most important philosophical texts of the 20th century are Being and Time, Philosophical Investigations, and Insight. And they should be brought together. The other two have had much more of an impact worldwide than Insight has had. But this is as great a book as those are. And they need to be integrated. I hate this thing of war between philosophical positions when it's not necessary. And there's a lot, there clearly are differences. And there are places where they will be irreconcilable. There's no question. But we'll see when we get to what he says about reading a philosophical text. You read a philosophical text at 35. You may end up disagreeing with some of its basic points, but you've learned a lot if you approach it that way. Hume said, knowing was simply a matter of the integration of sense impressions. Lonergan disagrees with that, but his reading of Hume taught him a lot about sensation. You know? And that's the way he read a book. And that's the way we have to read them. And that's the way, that's why in the paper that I did this summer, which I mentioned at the very end, I'm seeking peace with Heidegger and Wittgenstein instead of this thing that, you know, position and counterposition. There's judgment, you have to make a judgment. Lonergan has the functional specialties, and somebody in Montreal came up with the dysfunctional specialties. And the fourth functional specialty is dialectic. And this person had the fourth dysfunctional specialty was neo-dialectic. And neo-dialectic is the functional specialty in which one commits oneself to avoiding conflict at all costs. Well, you can't do that. There are times when you got to take a stand. But there's so much premature taking of stands that does not incorporate and learn from what others have done and have written. I'm terminating. Cora?
Well, is that word deception in your last paragraph a word with particular meaning in the philosophers that you engaged in?
No, I was looking, I want to come up with another name for this so-called first love other than experience. And what I think the first, what I think is going on at that initial conscious awakening is reception of data, you know. But the point that I was making in the paper this summer is that even among the data are not just sense impressions and that sort of thing, which is what he's emphasizing, but also meanings and values that we receive that are passed on to us in the tradition and so on. And we receive them at that first level, and then we have to make them our own or criticize them and reject them through this process of further questioning. But we do receive, we're taught. And we're taught not just, we learn not only bodily movements and colors and sounds, we learn meanings and values as well. And even in our adult life, but particularly as children, we enter into a whole world mediated by meaning that is taught to us. And we have to start with that, and then we go on from there.
Are they meanings and values, yes, or are they data?
I'm saying that among the data are meanings and values precisely as data, precisely as we see it. And Verstehen,
yeah,
understanding, is involved. I mean, the empirical consciousness of a human being is the empirical consciousness of an intelligent being. And so there's going to be experience, the capacity to understand is going to influence the very reception of data. The same thing is true in dreams. I mean, while you're dreaming, if it's a big dream, it's the dream of a supremely intelligent person. You know, I mean, there's something going on there that reflects the drama of the life of an intelligent person. So there's insight in dreams. You know,
but is all that potential, or does it have to move through?
No, it has to. It's different.
The whole process of
it's different. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because this is the latest stage of this whole.
Yeah.
But it's
just
different.
You peaked it by
the understanding that goes on as you are accepting meanings from your tradition, for instance, and there is an understanding that goes on. It is different from Lonergan's insight as a release to the tension of inquiry. It's a different operation. This is creative and comes out of your own question, right? But what I'm saying, and I don't think you would deny this, is that there's an understanding dimension at this empirical level that is prior to your own insight that came out of your own question, where you either perhaps have deeper understanding of this, or you're raising questions, what about this, and so on, you're engaged in your own creative process. But in Heidegger's terms, Verstehen is an existential of Dasein, at Dasein's basic being in the world, is understanding of Dasein. But it's not. Heidegger's Verstehen is not Lonergan's insight as a release to the tension of acquiring. It's understanding at this level. There's an understanding that's involved in the very reception of meaning. That's what I'm arguing, at least. I haven't yet had Bill Richardson, you know, as a Heidegger person. I left my paper with him, but he hasn't responded to it. I want to make sure that I'm reading Heidegger correctly. But there were others who thought that it made sense at the workshop. But I had Richardson for Heidegger back in '68 for one of the best courses, one of the most difficult courses, one of the best courses I've ever had. But I've been wrestling with the relationship between Heidegger and Lonergan ever since. And this is sort of the latest latest development in that interchange. Yes, Frank.
I'm just in trying to understand these last paragraphs. Something that comes to mind is Tolkien's essay on fairy stories. And he says that the function of the fairy story is to excite desire. Is that part of what this dialectic interplay of an autonomous but related movement of life before intentional operations? Would that?
Yes. I mean, in shorthand answer, yes. I mean, desire is the thing, and that's it. You know, and the desire. I mean, that's another way of saying what I'm trying to say at the end of that is that the desire to know is a part of a far more fulsome desire. Okay, it's part. I mean, the desire to know is the desire that is emphasized in the book Insight. As he went on, he came to see more and more. That's part of something bigger.
Yes, well,
and the bigger keeps getting bigger as he's thinking about it.
Well, you see, Tolkien then goes on to suggest that the function of the Gospels is to excite desire.
Absolutely.
And he connects that with the sub-creation of fiction or fantasy.
That's right.
With real creation.
That's right.
And that the object is joy.
If I could just real quick return to this bit that you were going to go. I'm just wondering, would that give a kind of explanation for the real deep entrenchment that Habermas talks about with systematic distortion, in the sense that bias with those values and meanings, that in that direct level of experience, so before the inner world of understanding, at the level of insight, we're inheriting bias that is. That's what's so dangerous about ideology, is it's so difficult to detect because it comes at that very base level of that.
And that's where what for better or for worse I call psychic conversion. That's where it goes to work. It has to go to work there. Shaler's got us something that's similar to this, that's not so much on the systematic distortion of communication among people, but in his Ressentiment, he talks about as an organic level of mendaciousness. And the mendacious person doesn't even have to lie. You know, I mean, the mendacious person just is, and is alive. You know, it's so deep, so it's organic. Learned patterns of behavior, however, can also become that organic. Racism is learned, but it can become organic. And it does become better. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Are we all right? All right. Moving forward. Okay, preface and introduction. Thank you. If any of you are in the course on the theology of history retreats on Friday afternoon, they will meet in the boardroom next door. That means sometimes get rather than over here. The boardroom on the first floor, at the back of the first floor. Because it's the only class on Friday afternoon and they are concerned about security leaving the same room. So they meet in the facility. And we'll have to put a note on the board. Okay, thank you.